The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late-night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Molly John Fast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds, and an investigation by the Supreme Court has been unable to determine who leaked the ruling overturning Roe. We have a show that spills a ton of tea. New York Times' Michael S. Schmidt details the extensive annoyance Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly, had to deal with. Then Politico's Rachel Bade talks about the slim chance Kevin McCarthy is a long-serving speaker. First, we have the host of MSNBC's The Lawrence O'Donnell Show, Lawrence O'Donnell. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Lawrence O'Donnell.
Oh, it is great to be back. This is the coolest thing I do. I can't wait to come back.
I was saying you were like a fan favorite besides having a television program. You worked in the Senate. You have a really good sense of what the history here is. And I think that all of us sort of forget, and especially right now, I mean, I'm curious to know, like, the Senate you worked in, those guys would just be so horrified by what's happening in Congress right now.
Yeah, 100% of them would be, with the possible exception of Jesse Helms. But really, at minimum of 99 of the senators that I worked around in those days, including, this is a name lost to history, Malcolm Wallop, who was by far the most conservative Republican senator of the 1990s, would be horrified by all of this because he was a decent person who had, you know, a sense of fairness and all of that. And what made him the most conservative Republican there was he was the closest thing to a libertarian in the Senate at the time, and still, you know, a thinking human being. It wasn't this nutty Paul family version. But he would be sickened by this. And Bob Dole, who was the Republican leader of the Senate, you know, during my time there, this is everything he feared about his own party. And he saw it beginning with Newt Gingrich. And Newt Gingrich hated Bob Dole. Newt Gingrich called Bob Dole the tax collector for the welfare state, because Bob Dole did not try to completely degrade the tax system of America. It's a horror beyond anyone's wildest imaginings. Here's the fun fact. We all thought, anyone working in the Congress and the Senate in the early 1990s, or at any point in the 1990s. We thought this is as bad as it can get. Isn't it too bad that we got to work here at the worst time? You know, because Gingrich Republicanism is getting a foothold, and it was already becoming a roadblocker. You know, Gingrich Republicanism roadblocked what we were trying to do on healthcare reform back then that Hillary Clinton was pushing for the White House, a kind of more complex version of what Obamacare eventually became. If it were not for Gingrich Republicanism, Bob Dole would have been able to reach a compromise with us in the Senate that would have produced legislation in 1994 that would have looked an awful lot like Obamacare. And so you would have had a version of Obamacare in place from 1995 onward, were it not for this creeping Gingrichism. And now those look like the glory days.
I often think about this. I just wrote a piece today about McCarthy's problem with Santos is not Santos. It's that Santos is not that different than Marjorie Taylor Greene or Paul Gosar. I mean, was it really a weak Republican Party that allowed itself to be kidnapped and held itself for ransom? Or is that too simplistic?
One of the problems on the Republican side of politics, beginning in the 1990s, was their language became ever more extreme, because even then, even before social media, Newt Gingrich noticed that extremism gets noticed. And when you're working, you know, in a body of 435, you know, and you're in the minority, which the Republicans were for 40 years before 1995, getting noticed is difficult. And Gingrich got noticed by being inflammatory. And once that happens, there's only one direction that's going to go forever. And so here you are, you know, 25 years later, and the extremist language just becomes more and more and more and more extreme. And it was during the Reagan period when they started to try to make and succeeded in making liberal a dirty word. And prior to that, you know, it wasn't. You could stand up and say liberal or conservative and mean it critically. You weren't saying that liberals themselves as human beings, you know, were evil, or conservatives themselves as human beings were evil. That really wasn't implicit in the kinds of criticisms that each side would offer about the other. And in those days, when you know, a liberal senator or a conservative senator would rise on the Senate floor right after his opponent spoke, and I say his because they were pretty much all men, and they would do that thing, you know, that looks incredibly phony, you know, like my distinguished friend from Missouri, and here's the thing. They meant it, right? And so that defined the dialogue then. It wasn't this vicious attack thing. What Gingrich invented was the complete demonization of the person. So they were not satisfied with criticizing the idea. They were going after the demonization of the person, because once you've demonized the person, every single thing that comes from that person is dismissible. And so Republicans went hardcore down that road of demonizing the people, and that's where they are now, right? So they don't have to. All you have to do is say the word Hillary in that world. That's it. You're done. You know, because they've completely demonized her and many others, so that you don't have to think about what they said. Here is a moment of 1994 in the United States Senate in the spring of how different that world was then. Because Leon Panetta, who was then the White House chief of staff, came up to the Democrats' policy luncheon, which I used to attend, because there's only two or three staff members who are allowed in that room. But the staff director of the Finance Committee has kind of a permanent pass to be in that room. So I was always in that room. And he had a strategy for the healthcare bill that the Democrats were trying to bring or have brought to the Senate floor and were struggling with on the Senate floor, where it ultimately died. And his strategy was, and he didn't like delivering this message, I know, because I know Leon, but the White House decision, the Clinton White House decision was the strategy of the day in the Senate should be demonize Dole. So all the senators were to go out there that day and demonize Bob Dole for opposing what Bill Clinton was trying to do on the Senate floor. And so there was that was greeted generally with silence. And
right.
I think Ted Kennedy and a couple others were ready to do it. But we were floor managing the bill, Senator Moynihan was. And so the first thing that happened after the lunch is we went out onto the Senate floor and Bob Kerry of Nebraska, Democratic Senator of Nebraska, asked to be recognized. And Senator Moynihan immediately recognized him. And Bob Kerry, who left half of a leg in Vietnam, got up and did a 10-minute speech in praise of Bob Dole, who is a fellow wounded warrior from World War II, like Bob Kerry is. And then, after his 10-minute praise of Bob Dole, he went on into his welfare, his healthcare argument of the day. And Bob Dole was not demonized on the Senate floor because that's not where our politics was. And now that's all our politics is. And it goes both ways. I mean, and by the way, it's become legitimate. There are some demons, to put it mildly, on the Republican side of our politics.
Oh, yeah. It's so interesting, though, because it's one of the things I keep thinking about is will this, because we're seeing already the McCarthy's House of Representatives, this 118th Congress is going to be filled with lunatics running oversight. I mean, running really important committees. So my question is, will this backfire the way the Clinton investigations backfired, or will this work the way Benghazi worked on Hillary?
Well, I think we're at the point where investigations probably don't have any real effect. There's a kind of a stunning polling number about this, which is if you look at the most important investigation of our lifetimes, and by the way, I include Since we're talking about our lifetimes, I include the Warren Commission investigation of the assassination of President Kennedy in that. The January 6th committee is the most important investigation of our lifetimes, and I believe the most important investigation ever conducted by Congress in its history. And Donald Trump's polling numbers were unchanged for the entire run of those of that investigation. Didn't change. It varied by about 1 point the entire time. Okay. So that tells you this. And by the way, that's not what happened when Richard Nixon was being investigated, you know, by Congress. Richard Nixon's numbers were going down consistently with the findings of the investigations and the revelations of the investigations, which is what you'd expect from a logical society. There's an indication in that that it doesn't matter what you do in investigations. It doesn't matter how many pictures of Hunter Biden's penis Republicans put up on the big screen and study in their hearings, that it's not going to change any minds one way or the other. And, you know, in terms of damage to the government, it's kind of the least damaging thing they can do is run a bunch of pointless and silly investigations.
We're certainly going to see a lot of that. And what I think is interesting, and we actually had a pollster on here who talked about this last episode, which is that Trump has lost three elections for Republicans, right? And what we saw in this midterm, especially, which I was very heartened by, and I think you were heartened by this too, but maybe I'm projecting, but that the voters did not like these crazy candidates like Carrie Lake. Unless it was a ruby red state, the voters really rejected these Trumpy candidates. So you would think that a Republican Party that was acting smartly would, you know, start to try to take the pain and change their track. But that's not happening.
No, and that's what every party did, you know, after elections. You know, after Reagan wiped out the Democrats, they all started moving in a more conservative direction. I mean, you went from having maybe a couple of dozen Democrats opposed to the death penalty, for example, in the Senate in the 1970s. By the end of the 1980s, they were all in favor of it. There was a lot of adjusting in that direction. And after Michael Dukakis lost, there was a lot of adjusting,
right,
you know, because of that. And on the Republican side, they used to try to do the same thing. That's just gone from a politics that is no longer in search of that voter in the middle. And, you know, there's a really important thing that I think it's it's in everyone's analysis, and it's so built in, I think, that many people have not quite noticed what they're doing. But the Republicans, the Trump Republicans, certainly, and Trump, do not now and never have had a plan to win the most votes for president. That's not even in the mix. The Trump calculation would include the possibility of coming in even farther behind the Democrat than he has in his previous two runs. And it's entirely about the Electoral College, 100% about the Electoral College. And so because you're not trying to get to the middle, you're not trying to win the most votes, then you don't have to get to the middle. You know, you just right. have to make sure everybody in South and North Dakota, you know, turns out, which they're going to do. And it's just an Electoral College strategy. It's not about winning the most votes. And once you drop off of trying to win the most votes and you still get to win the election, that's when you get the kind of, you know, non-corrective postures that you're seeing on the Republican side.
Eventually, though, they're going to have to take the pain.
I don't know if they are. I don't see exactly why they would. The other thing that's happening is the general and specific intelligence level within the operatives of the Republican Party is declining dramatically. Okay. So, you know, Kevin McCarthy is many things, including the single stupidest Speaker of the House in the history of the Congress. And so no one can expect Kevin McCarthy to figure anything out. You know, if you're trying to figure something out and you've got to talk to a Republican, call Mitch McConnell. I don't know who your second call is. That's how thin the strategic thinking bench is. And Mitch McConnell's not going to live forever.
You know? Right.
So, you know, Bill Kristol was an astonishingly powerful influencer before the term influencer was invented in the 1990s in the Republican Party. He had been Dan Quayle's chief of staff as vice president.
Yes.
And Bill's father was a respected conservative thinker. And Bill Kristol, out of office, kind of not even in our politics, wrote a memo in 1993, circulated in Washington, about why the Republicans should oppose the Clinton health care plan and not offer an alternative to it, but just oppose it and vote it down. And that memo became the controlling strategic approach to health care eventually. Even Bob Dole had to go along with it. And that kind of thing is impossible now. I mean, what is Matt Schlapp is going to write a memo here's how to adjust your behavior. Matt Schlapp's going to write that memo. Here's how to adjust your approach to convincing people to do what you want them to do. There's no brain left, no strategic brain left in and around the Republican Party to adjust to anything.
So interesting. Thank you, Lawrence.
Thank you very much.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Michael S. Schmidt is a reporter at the New York Times and author of Donald Trump versus the United States.
Welcome to Fast Politics, Mike Schmidt.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's first talk about the paperback publication of your book, and then we will talk of other things. The book, Donald Trump v. the United States, Inside the Struggle to Stop a President. First, I want to ask you, which I think is like the question I always want to ask, is like, this is actually a really annoying question, so get ready. What stuff did you find out after the book came out that you wish you could have put in there?
So what I did was, is that as the book was coming out, I sort of realized that there was not a hole in it, but there was a part of it that could be built onto it that I had sort of not told. And that was the story of John Kelly. And I had written a book about the attempts to stop Donald Trump. And it mainly focused on Don McGahn and on Jim Comey. And as I got done, I said, you know, if I had all the time in the world and all the energy, I would have written more about Kelly. So what I decided to do is that I took a lot of time and I went out and I tried to tell his story. And instead of the paperback coming out a year after the book comes out, we delayed it. And I did a 12,000-word biography on Kelly and his times with Trump. Because I said, you know what? I wrote this book. I'm probably not going to write a book about John Kelly, but I think his story is important. And it's another way to go out and talk about the book again and talk about the work that I did and tell what I think is an important story. So I did this crazy thing, and we've added this whole addition onto the book, these 12,000 words. And here I am, you know, talking about it again, I think telling an important story.
One of my kids is like super into military. We were actually talking about this. And I want to ask you, someone like John Kelly, I mean, I feel like what happened to him is kind of the worst thing that can ever happen to a career military man.
I think that's right. Now, I don't think that there's part of it where Kelly should not be sort of let off the hook. And it's not right. My job to sort of hold people accountable. It's to tell their stories. But I think an important part of his story is that he did end up in Donald Trump's orbit.
Right.
And he had sort of a miscalculation about Trump. He thought that Trump's rhetoric was more about politics, and that when Trump got to Washington, he was going to be sobered by the job and sobered by the process, and was going to be forced to behave in a way that was not like what he was on the campaign trail. And John Kelly, being sort of a career military person, said, well, I'd work for Hillary Clinton. I'd work for any president to ask me to do anything. And because of that, finds himself in Trump's orbit, thinking that the institutions will bind Trump. And obviously that turns out not to be true, but Kelly finds himself in Trump's orbit. Then, you know, he's his secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, and Trump sort of snookers him into becoming his chief of staff. And he's in the White House in July of 2017. And he says, oh shit, this is far worse than I thought it was. I thought that Trump needed process and he needed to be better staffed. And he says, oh my gosh, this person is worse than I ever could have imagined. He later told people, I didn't know they made people like that. Now, Kelly could have quit at that point. He could have said, you know what, screw this, I'm out of here. And he could have done that, but he said, look, I wasn't going to quit on the battlefield. I'm not going to quit in the Oval Office. And he basically takes as much pain as he can for the next 18 months to try and contain an unbound president.
Right. I mean, and then he finds himself in this absolute partisan disaster.
So I think Kelly going to the White House for Kelly was like crossing a line that he never wanted to cross.
Right.
He looks down on partisan politics. I mean, I don't think he would say I look down on it, but he does not think highly of partisan politics.
Right. Well, the whole idea of these guys is that they consider themselves to be beyond it.
And here he is basically going to work for the most political creature of all time. You know, someone who doesn't have fundamental beliefs and is literally just a political creature. And I think that really bothered him. But he realized he was so far in at that point that he wasn't going to quit. But the White House was such a much more political place than the Department of Homeland Security, even though the Department of Homeland Security, where he was also political. But it was a cabinet post. It's, in Kelly's eyes, it's a national security job. It's probably the most thankless cabinet post because it's got the most difficult issues, and it has the elite doesn't have the prestige of being Secretary of State or Secretary of Defense. So to him, he finds himself with Trump, who's like the most political thing. And like, Kelly doesn't have political aims. He's not Don McGahn trying to remake the federal court system, right? He's not, you know, a liberal like maybe a Gary Cohn who found himself in Trump's orbit and thought they could, you know, do something good in their area of expertise. He's like a national security guy who's like apolitical and now finds himself with a president of the United States who is far stupider than he thought, far more immoral than he thought, lazier than he thought, and more dangerous than he thought. And he says, oh, you know, holy shit, if I thought this was a problem before I got in here, this is much worse than I ever could have imagined.
It does seem to me like a case of everything Trump touches dies.
If you think about the post-9/11 generation of military officers, right? Kelly was a guy who had fought in the invasion of Iraq. He had done another tour in Iraq. He had been the top military advisor to the defense secretary, which is a very elite, prestigious role in the military, where you're essentially the military officer, chief of staff to the defense secretary. He had been the head of Central Command and had sat in the Oval Office or the Situation Room in the White House with Obama and told Obama things he didn't want to hear about the border and about what Kelly thought the threats were to the United States. He was one of a handful of four-star Marine generals. The Marines are different than the Army. They do not have so many generals. The Army has lots and lots of generals. At its height, the Marines had 6 4-star Marine generals. And on top of all of this, he's the highest ranking military officer to lose a child on the battlefield in the post-9/11 wars. His son was killed in Afghanistan. So he comes to this with as a stellar a military record as there could be. And John Kelly was not a controversial general that ran his mouth to Rolling Stone.
Right,
Kelly was not a controversial general who became a huge media figure and then had to plead guilty to mishandling classified information like David Petraeus. He was a post-9/11 four-star Marine general. And he has to battle with Trump and walks out of it with the muck of Trump all over him. And unlike a political character, doesn't go out and tell a story. John Kelly hasn't written a book. Have you ever seen John Kelly on television?
No, right.
So he's not that type of character. So he's not going to go out and sort of craft his message. He's going to say, look, I serve my country. you know, thanks a lot. I'm going to, you know, recede to cutting down trees or clearing brush or whatever he does.
Right.
And, you know, talking to military groups and law enforcement groups about leadership. I mean, these are not political characters, but at the same time, his legacy and history has been infused by someone who he hates in Donald Trump. And so he's conflicted by that.
So I want to talk to you about one of the scoops in this addendum, which is this idea that Kelly may have stopped him from bombing North Korea. And it certainly seemed with a lot of the reporting that we saw coming out of the Trump White House that Trump had a very itchy nuke finger that he was not able to use. Can you talk about this?
So I think that this is, and this is like one of these examples where like the success of what Kelly's done here will never weigh as much as if it had been a failure. If this had been a failure, then this would have been like one of the defining things of Trump's presidency, if not American history. And basically what happens is that when Kelly comes in, he realizes that not only is Trump, you know, far worse than he thought he was, but that the biggest problem he has, and if you remember at the time, we think the biggest problems are the Mueller investigation or Trump obstructing justice or his ties to Russia. Kelly is completely convinced the biggest problem is the fact that Donald Trump may put the United States at war with North Korea because his public rhetoric is signaling that he wants to use force. He's also saying that in private. The North Koreans are responding with tests and with their own rhetoric. And Kelly, being a student of history, thinks signals can easily be misread. You have two people here who need to appear strong. And if there is one thing that goes wrong, and let's say the North Koreans launch a missile somewhere towards the United States and we have to shoot it down, we're going to have to respond. And all of a sudden, we're going to be at war. And we're going to be at war with Donald Trump as our president. And Donald Trump trying to look strong. And he says, holy shit, this could be awful. So what he does is he's like, I got to get a handle on this. And he tries to use process to sort of like get this back on track. And he brings in the other generals and they brief Trump and they say, look, if you do this, you know, here are the options we have and here are the consequences and thousands of people could die if there was a conflict and that doesn't get through to Trump. And Kelly tells Trump, you're going to destroy the economy that you created and that doesn't get through to Trump. And Kelly, sort of searching for some way to get through to Trump, finally appeals to his ego and says, look, you're the ultimate deal maker. Every president back to Eisenhower has never been able to cut the greatest deal in the world with the North Koreans. You can do this. Why don't you engage directly with Kim? You are the deal maker. You're so good at this. And Kelly does this knowing that it's not going to lead to a denuclearized North Korea, but it is going to ratchet back the public rhetoric and the public and private rhetoric about war. And if you remember, Trump saying Little Rocket Man, fire and fury. I mean, these are very famous moments in the Trump presidency. And they're famous because Trump is looking like he has an itchy trigger finger. And like from the United States, like, oh, it's one thing if Trump has an itchy trigger finger. But if you're North Korea, you're like, holy shit, this guy's really going to do this. And the North Koreans are obsessed with the United States. And here's a president who says, I'm going to bomb you. So Kelly is terrified they're going to take some sort of move. And by doing that, he moves Trump off that rhetoric. Because if you look at the arc of the Trump presidency, one of the greatest unanswered questions is like, how do we go from fire and fury and Little Rocket Man and my button's bigger than yours to the love letters? Like, how did you get there? It's like, and it was one of these things that sort of happened and we didn't know the story in between. And look, I'm sure there's a lot of reasons we got there, but one of them was because John Kelly in one-on-ones with Donald Trump, John Kelly, who probably spent more one-on-one time with Trump than anyone else in 17 and 18, is saying, you're the greatest deal maker in the world. You can do this. And Kelly's trying to charm him into charming Kim to stop this rhetoric. And he's successful at it.
It's so interesting. So were there other places in which Kelly was able to kind of trick Trump into not going to war?
On war, no. I mean, I think Kelly spends a lot of his time just trying to get through the day with Trump. In terms of military stuff, I don't know what else Kelly was able to talk Trump off of. I know he talked to him a lot about the border and tried to stop Trump right. from doing these outrageous things at the border, putting alligators in the water, shooting people in the legs.
Right. And also bombing, right?
Yeah. And using force against Mexico and pointing the finger at someone else. Trump had told Kelly that he wanted to use a nuclear weapon. He cavalierly said, well, why don't we use a nuclear weapon against North Korea and just blame another country? And Kelly says, you can't do that. It's going to be very difficult to do that. You can't just point the finger at someone else. But Kelly's battle was just a day-to-day battle with Trump to get through the day. And most presidencies are like planned out like months, you know, weeks in advance. And Kelly just tried to get through the day. He would just be prepared for Trump to come down sometime late in the morning from the residence and be obsessed with something he saw on television and let that dominate the rest of his day and just try and get through that day without Trump breaking the law, doing something unethical, damaging himself or damaging the country. That was the day-to-day goal of John Kelly. He didn't have the ability to think any further ahead than that.
You had a scoop that DOJ had talked to Mike Pence in November. Remember November? What do you think is happening with the DOJ?
At some point, DOJ reaches out to Pence's side to say, we're going to want to talk to Pence. And that begins what will be a lengthy process in which the Justice Department tries to talk to Pence. What will happen is that Trump's lawyers will come in to try and stop that, block that, you know, narrow the questions because of executive privilege. And it will go on for some time. We've seen similar fights like this in terms of getting the cooperation of people like Pence's chief of staff, Mark Short. It does not mean that Pence is going to go flying into a grand jury tomorrow, but it means that they're on that process and they're on that track. It's just a sign of how long and slow these things take. I don't think there is a more deliberative, slow body than the United States Justice Department. And I realize that leaves a lot of people frustrated on all sides, but we're just on a slow track here in which it will go along and go along for months and months and months until we really have any clarity about what they're doing.
So we do have now two different special counsels, one dealing with the Biden papers, one dealing with the very different case of all of the Trump papers. I do feel like the more Trump tweets, well, he's not tweeting anymore, truths, the more Trump truths about the documents, the more it actually hurts him, right? Like he was truthing about all the empty folders.
I think you raise a good point because I think some of the conventional wisdom has been, and I've said this myself, that the fact that Biden did this makes it more difficult to prosecute Trump because the question of prosecuting a former president or someone who's running for president is so extraordinary that it's not just that you have to explain it to a jury. You're going to have to explain it to the American people. And the American people are going to have to, in a digestible way, understand why you're doing what you're doing. And if Biden's Justice Department, while Biden and Trump are running against each other, charges Donald Trump, just think about like how extraordinary that would be. And the first reaction of people is, well, didn't Joe Biden do that? And it's a difficult thing to explain to the public. I can see the Justice Department having real pause about that because it'll be politicizing the department in a way that I'm sure someone like Merrick Garland will be very concerned about. At the same time, if Donald Trump continues to talk and act in a way that is in your face, above the law, admitting to crimes, looking like he's interfering with the investigation, he puts the department continuously in this position of like, okay, so like, I understand you weren't going to prosecute him for these things, but he went on to admit to all of them and he interfered in the investigation and threw sand in the gears of it in the process. And I think that if you're Donald Trump's lawyer and Donald Trump is listening to you, you know, Donald Trump stops talking. That has never happened.
Right.
And that just doesn't happen. So, but when I saw his comments yesterday, I thought to myself, you know, if he keeps this up, he makes it even harder on the department. And I know people will say, look, you know, the public, you know, what goes on in the public rhetoric should not affect what the department's going to do. But like at the end of the day, this is such a big decision to charge someone like Trump that everything that goes on publicly will have some sort of role in it. And it can't help him.
Right. No, I mean, it does seem like he's hurting himself. Mike Schmidt, I hope you will come back.
Thank you so much for having me.
I know you, our dear listeners, are very busy, and you don't have time to sort through the hundreds of pieces of punditry each week. This is why every week I put together a newsletter of my five favorite articles on politics. If you enjoy the podcast, you will love having this in your inbox every Friday. So sign up at fastpoliticspod.com and click the tab to join our mailing list. That's fastpoliticspod.com. Rachel Bade is a senior Washington correspondent at Politico and author of Unchecked. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Rachel.
Thanks for having me on, Molly.
I have been dying to talk to you about this Congress. And every time I read Playbook, I'm like, I have to talk to her. I just am dying because it's like every day is to have a Congress. I mean, I know Congress has had historically, I mean, we just had Lawrence on. We talked a lot about history. There's been crazy shit that's happened in Congress before, but I feel like what's happening now is theatrical on a whole other level.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be like watching a wrestling match every single day. For reporters, it's fun. I covered the last House Republican majority under President Obama, and that had a lot of fireworks, but this is going to be like something we've never seen, at least in recent years.
Let's just talk about what this sort of stage is. McCarthy has the speakership, 14 votes, got it on the 15th. But this is what I don't understand. And maybe this is a stupid question, but I'm sure my dad will appreciate this. McCarthy got it on the 15th vote. And people like Matt Gaetz never voted for McCarthy, right? He just changed his vote to present. But yet, you know, like he didn't go after Matt Gaetz for not supporting him.
He doesn't have the power to do that. He's going to be an incredibly weak speaker because of this very slim margin he has in the House right now, being able to only lose five Republicans at any given time. And because of that, conservatives, you know, he basically had to give away the store. He gave them a lot of plush committee assignments, which we sort of saw the results of that this week. We can talk more in detail about that. One of the sort of bigger things he gave them was three seats on the House Rules Committee. And that might seem like very wonky in terms of like technical language for listeners, but it's really important because while he got the gavel, he gave away the House. That panel sets the rules for the floor and basically dictates what any given bill looks like, no matter what it looks like coming out of committee. So conservatives now run the place. McCarthy is speaker in name only. And because of that, he doesn't have the ability to punish these guys, because if he does, they could motion to oust him at any moment and they could easily get the votes to send him packing from Washington. This is a lot different than Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who, yes, she had a little bit of a rebellion on her hands when she became speaker again in 2019. But she not only, you know, won her critics, she also punished them.
Right.
That relates to your question. And, you know, people, because of that, were afraid to cross her.
Yeah, that was my question. Talk to us about this Rules Committee. And then the other thing I just want you to answer for me, because this is something I've read about, but I haven't gotten to ask any congressional reporters. So you're more than just a congressional reporter, but we still don't know the extent of the things that McCarthy promised.
I'll start there on that. So there's been a lot of controversy because a lot of Republicans who have been loyal to McCarthy have sort of been privately squawking about everything he has given these conservatives. I mean, they say they have been loyal to him. They weren't trying to use their vote to leverage, you know, plum committee posts, et cetera. But the most sort of sensitive issue is this question of who's sitting on what committees. I remember there was this meeting that happened right off the floor when one of the conservatives was trying to get a subcommittee gavel on the House Appropriations Committee, which obviously dictates where government money is spent. It's a very powerful panel. And one of the conservatives wanted to lead one of those subcommittees. And, you know, Kay Granger, who's the chairwoman of that panel, and all her cardinals, subcommittee chairmen who already have those positions, met off the floor and were like, McCarthy cannot do this. He's going to have a problem with us if he does this. McCarthy came out and said he has not promised any gavels for this position and for these votes. But we saw one of those members get a subcommittee gavel, one of those conservatives. Conservatives this week. And so there are a lot of members who are, frankly, they don't trust McCarthy. They feel like he has said a lot of things publicly over the years and then done different things privately. So there's a lot of distrust right now. And people are upset that a lot of these conservatives ended up on these plush panels when they feel like they didn't earn them.
Yeah, that's going to be a problem for McCarthy because he's going to need that when he wants to pass stuff, right?
That's exactly right. And also, you know, you mentioned the Rules Committee and wanting to know more about that. The reason that panel is significant is because, like I said, they sort of dictate what bills look like that come to the floor, whether they're allowed to have certain amendments or not. It's basically always been seen as the, quote, Speaker's Committee, sort of stocked full of the Speaker's most loyal allies who will basically do the bidding of leadership. And it's been like that for decades, since like the 1960s or something. What McCarthy did was give conservatives all the power by putting them on these panels. And that means chairmen and chairwomen who are, you know, passing bills in committee and then sending them to the rules panel, they have different views than a lot of these conservatives. You know, they might be more pragmatic, more moderate, but now these conservatives can take those bills and totally change them to look like what they want to look like. And so that's going to cause, again, a lot of internal drama amongst McCarthy's members.
So who is on this House Rules Committee?
They're determining all that this week. We're going to see at least three conservatives, and that's going to be enough to basically have a veto power over everything. And then one other thing I would say about the rules panel, its job is not only to decide what legislation comes to the floor, its job is also to decide what doesn't come to the floor. And that's just as important because there's a lot of moderate members who don't want to take votes on, you know, issues that the base really loves. For instance, with Democrats, it was Medicare for All. Pelosi specifically made sure no amendment ever came to the floor on Medicare for All because she didn't want to put her frontliners in these very difficult positions.
Right.
But now conservatives are going to make Republicans in districts that Biden won take a whole host of votes on really controversial things that the base loves, but that would really hurt them politically. So, again, something to keep an eye on going forward.
Oh, that is so interesting. Right. That makes a lot of sense. And there are a bunch of new congresspeople, right, who came from Biden districts.
That's right. And now they're going to be having to take these votes that are no doubt going to be used in ads against them, which could potentially make them lose the House in the fall. So again, McCarthy putting his ambition to be speaker over perhaps the good of the majority in a lot of people's views.
So I want to talk about the debt ceiling because that feels like a sort of a kind of anvil. If this is an episode of Roadrunner, that anvil is right over McCarthy's head and also all of our heads. Can you explain to us sort of where that is right now?
Well, everybody's trying to figure out how they're going to find a way to get out of this. I mean, McCarthy has basically drawn this line in the sand saying that they are not going to raise a debt ceiling unless they get Republicans get some sort of mandatory cuts to mandatory spending like Social Security, Medicaid, etc. But obviously Democrats control the Senate and the White House and they're not going to go for that. And so the problem Republicans have is for three times under Donald Trump, they raised the debt ceiling without any cuts and without even having a discussion about demands for these spending cuts. Now that, you know, they don't have power anymore or they only have the House, they want to make these demands when they passed up their own opportunity to do something about this. And so, number one, it looks, you know, hypocritical. Number two, with Democrats not being willing to make these cuts, we could potentially see a default on the debt, which, you know, the X deadline, everybody calls it, that's going to come up in June. And so, you know, McCarthy is facing this threat of being ousted as speaker from conservatives if he were to just put a clean debt limit bill on the floor to, you know, raise the debt ceiling without any cuts. And so it's going to be up to a band of moderate Republicans to join with Democrats in the House to basically do this end run around McCarthy to try to raise the debt ceiling and avoid this sort of economic calamity that is we're looking at right now. And that's not easy to do. You know, it sounds simple, but, you know, a lot of these Republicans, if they're willing to do that, the chances are they're going to face their own primaries back home. They're going to get, you know, assailed by people like Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham. And so it's not as easy as it sounds for these guys. And so it's going to be ugly. And I think, like, for the first time in a long time, reporters on the Hill are concerned that it's not only going to be, you know, a downgrading of the U.S. credit rating like we saw a couple years ago amid this brinksmanship. It could actually be a default of some sort. And that could have devastating consequences on every single American in various forms.
I mean, that does seem like a real danger that could be imminent.
That's right. And one of the big headlines that came out this week was that House Republicans, McCarthy and these conservatives, they're trying to put together this plan to, quote, prioritize payments when we hit the X date. So basically say, okay, if we're hitting up against default, yes, Janet Yellen at the Treasury Department, you're going to pay our creditors, you're going to pay Social Security, you're going to pay for the military, but you're going to stop all this other funding. And basically, that would be a 20% across the board cut to all these programs from, you know, food stamps to housing assistance to even, you know, for Republicans who care about the border, it would even be border security that would get cut. So the problem with this is Jack Lew, the previous Treasury Secretary under Obama, he called this, quote, default by another name, because you're still not paying bills that you've already authorized spending for. And so it won't solve any problems. It likely will still result in a credit downgrade. And not only that, but Democrats will never pass a bill lining up this sort of strategy. They just won't go for it.
We're going to hit a sort of brinksmanship. I think, and again, you know this better than I do, but it does seem like McCarthy's having a very hard time getting his people to even do things he wants. So how is he going to get them to sort of come along with something that he's sort of on the fence about anyway, right? I mean, getting these cuts passed, it's not the clearest thing to do anyway, you know, and there's going to be a lot of dissent about what to cut and how to cut it. And ultimately, if he can't get elected speaker, how can he do more complicated bills?
He can't. And so I think a lot of the question, you know, Republicans are asking right now privately is how long will he be speaker? And what manner is he going to go out in terms of leaving the House? McCarthy, you know, if he's being realistic, should be thinking in legacy mode. What sort of legacy does he want to leave? What's the last thing he wants to do in Congress? And, you know, if he's thinking that way, perhaps he sort of falls on his sword and says, look, conservatives, like we put up a good fight. Democrats are not going to do this. We have to raise a debt ceiling, and tries to lead a portion of his conference to vote with Democrats to raise a debt ceiling before something terrible happens to the economy. And then he would, of course, be ousted. They would motion to vacate and they would have to elect a new speaker. Or he could do what we've sort of seen him do in the past few months and actually the past couple years, which is he sort of leans on his moderate Republican members to do the hard job, right? And he plays the antagonist who's on the side of conservatives. So it gives them sort of a wink and a nod to go ahead and team up with Democrats or say something publicly that would help him. We saw him do this in the speaker's race quite effectively, actually. It was moderate Republicans who were saying, look, if we don't have McCarthy, we could potentially see a speaker, Hakeem Jeffries, which was never going to happen, but it was a talking point that helped McCarthy. And so they certainly circulated it. So will those moderate Republicans take the wink and the nod from McCarthy, join with Democrats? But again, they're going to get pummeled. So it's not easy. He's basically pushing these members out to do the dirty work for him to try to save his speakership.
So crazy. I mean, he's really gotten himself in an impossible situation.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be tough. And I mean, even if I think the debt ceiling, the fact that it's coming in June now, which was one of the big headlines of this week, it doesn't give lawmakers a lot of time to figure this out. I mean, I think originally we were thinking we were going to hit the debt ceiling in the fall, sometime around like September, October. That timeline means these conversations need to happen right now. There has been a little bit of talk about a, quote, discharge petition where five Republicans will team up with all Democrats in the House to force a vote on a clean debt ceiling bill. But even that has complications. It takes forever to do. And they would basically have to start the process like in the next couple of days if they want to do this before that June X deadline. So it's really not looking good. And it's anyone's guess as where this could go. One last thing I would mention on the debt ceiling is Joe Manchin, who is in Davos, I believe, this week.
I would hope so.
He floated this idea of a, quote, rescue committee with McCarthy, apparently recently, basically suggesting to him, you guys raise the debt ceiling with us and we will form this panel where they will look at mandatory spending, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, et cetera, and come up with ways to make them solvent in the long run. And, you know, we'll do that together. But the problem is This has been tried before with the Super Committee in 2011, and it failed abysmally. So why would it work now when Washington is even more partisan than we've ever seen? It's really hard to predict where this is going to go, but that's something else to keep an eye on.
That could give them a good cover, though, those Republicans, right, if they wanted to sign on.
It could. It certainly could, but probably not enough of a cover to keep Matt Gaetz from filing a motion to vacate Kevin McCarthy and booting him from Washington.
My question is the talented Mr. Santos.
Yeah.
I mean, every single day. Drudge has like a little section on him now.
I know. I feel like every Washington publication probably just needs a subhead somewhere on their website. Latest Santos drama. It's crazy. I mean, I remember this week reading that story. I don't know if you saw that story about
the dog or the scarf.
The dog scamming a wounded veteran and his assistant dog who needed emergency surgery, raising money for that surgery, and then stealing the funds and not letting the dog, you know, the dog ends up dying. It's just horrible. Like, how do you do this? So what's going to happen to this guy? I mean, obviously, there's going to be a ton of federal investigations, but the reality is those things take time. In the House, McCarthy, because of his very slim majority, he's not going to move to punish this guy in any way, sense, or form. He's seated on a committee. I think it's a small business committee, given that he's lied about everything in his past.
Right.
But McCarthy's sort of line on this is, you know, Republicans or anybody who's accused of something, you know, an investigation has to play out. There will be a House Ethics Committee investigation as well. But again, that panel rarely rebukes members and takes forever to do anything. So this guy's going to be in Congress for a while.
Yeah. Can you just explain one last thing? And then I promise I'll let you go. There was talk about McCarthy stripping the Ethics Committee. I mean, the Ethics Committee, by the way, has never punished anyone ever. So, I mean, not ever, but, you know, it's not famous for its, swift justice. But
yeah.
Is that being stripped or no?
Yeah, so there's this outside sort of congressional ethics watchdog who in the past has made referrals to the Ethics Committee, and a lot of them have actually gone places. Although, like you said, the committee rarely punishes anyone because they're run by lawmakers who don't want to be punished themselves. So there's that conflict. Basically, McCarthy is deactivating that sort of outside watchdog group. And so there's a lot of concern about who's going to be telling the public about some of these things that are not happening. I mean, in theory, this group could still do their investigations and go public and try to sort of force some sort of public action on members. But the fact that there's no longer going to be this partnership, I mean, leaves Congress open for a lot of misuse and abuse. So it's going to be a problem.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Rachel. I hope you will come back.
I will. Anytime.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Molly Jungfast.
Jesse Cannon.
Trump, you're always wondering, is it the cognitive decline? Is it having no filter? Is he just a moron? Tell us what happened and what your take is.
We're talking about the E. Jean Carroll case. E. Jean Carroll, friend of the show and friend of mine and friend of my mother's a long time ago, is pressing charges against Trump. They are going to trial actually quite soon. During one of the depositions, Trump made this mistake confusing a picture of E. Jean with a picture of Marla Maples.
Who we should note, for those who don't remember ancient history, is his former wife.
One of Trump's typical, very classy defenses was that he would not rape E. Jean because she wasn't hot enough. This is, like, by the way, his favorite defense because it's both misogynistic. And also misogynistic. This confusion of E. Jean Carroll and Marla Maples actually shows that he thought she was his wife, ergo he did find her attractive enough to want to engage with. And thus, he gets a hearty fuck you from us. Donald Trump is our moment of fuckery yet again, forever and ever and always.
A true king.
A true king. That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.